BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Miss Marshbank's machinations lead to the solving of a mystery and to a wedding in the final part of the Carlingford Chronicles at 3. Until then, Hannah Gordon reads episode 5 of Muriel Spark, the biography by Martin Stannard. We see Muriel entering a more peacefully restless period of her life, thanks to the influence of her companion, Penelope Jardine.
Muriel's novel, The Public Image, draws obliquely on her first year in Rome, although it also reaches back through her whole history as an artist. When it appeared in the UK and the USA in 1968, however, the reception was mixed. Was it confessional? Much is owed to the circumstances of Muriel Spark's new life, said the New York Times, as an international star novelist, with a public image of her own to bear. Confessional it certainly was not. But this critic had hit on something, for the book was in part a study of a relationship which taxed Muriel, that between identity and fame. In the equally large clutch of glowing notices, this and connected themes left fellow writers dazzled. Frank Kermode saw a dark moral fable. Rome, the centre of truth, is also a centre of phonies. The following spring, 1969, it was one of the selections for the first Booker Prize. Muriel took it all in her stride. The prize of £5,000 generated considerable journalistic heat. Muriel peered at the cavalcade through imaginary lorgnettes. She didn't win, and she didn't care. Muriel had already suffered too much publicity. Her correspondents now needed to decode her messages. In hospital, in the country, out of the country, going to South America, usually signalling that she wished to remain undisturbed. For years, she used her hospital, the Salvator Mundi, as a place in which to disappear. There were also, however, many visits for medical reasons. A check-up in November 1968 revealed the need for a hysterectomy. At the time, she kept the nature of her operation private from all but a few, notably her friend and assistant, the sculptor Penelope Jardine. In December 1974, Muriel flew to England for publicity for her new novel, The Abbess of Crewe, and to spend Christmas and New Year with her son Robin. In London, she had finally succumbed to appearing on a chat show, Russell Harty's, and had charmed both him and his audience. She seemed at ease. This equanimity was in part due to recent success, and in part to Penelope Jardine. They had been friends for 7 years. Often away from Rome now, Jardine was supervising the restoration of a dilapidated priest's house with adjoining church in rural Tuscany, and planned to live there. Stone-built, 13th-century rustic, the whole site was ruinous. But Jardine had plans, and San Giovanni, as the house was known, was to be her home. Muriel was to become an increasingly frequent visitor, and eventually it was to become her home too. In Tuscany, in her 60s, a more peacefully restless phase of Muriel's life was opening. Jardine now knew Muriel better than anyone, and knew her well enough to leave her alone, to be there only when wanted. But San Giovanni was Jardine's house, and remained so throughout the 30-odd years of the two women's time together there. Muriel never paid rent or contributed to the costs of the rebuilding. Instead, she supplied the means of escape, the cars, the holidays, the meals out, the business trips across Europe. Jardine always drove. At home, she cooked, washed up, catered for guests, and generally acted as a personal assistant, keeping the world at bay. In one respect, Muriel's life had always been like this. She was a cuckoo, perching in others' nests, a go-away bird, always ready to take flight. In another respect, this relationship was becoming quite different from anything else she had experienced. Slowly, almost reluctantly, she was learning to love again. "Now I'm 81, Muriel remarked in 1999, "and I think the happiest years of my life started between 60 and 70. For one thing, I can handle life. Up till the time I was 60, I was never very capable of saying no, of really saying, this is the way I do it, and being absolutely firm." Too often she felt she had wasted energy humouring those staking claims on her time. In the early 1970s, her son Robin and her publisher Macmillan remained on her loyalty list. By the end of the decade, both were well on their way to becoming history. Muriel had dutifully visited Robin in Edinburgh in 1974, 1975 and 1976. He had been sending her chatty epistles, and she had replied in similar vein, apparently enclosing the odd cheque by way of a present. But there were two problems which obstructed familiarity. He insisted that Muriel was fully Jewish through the female line, and he had artistic ambitions of his own. In May 1981, Robin wrote Muriel a stiff letter stating that since she continued to insist that her mother and grandmother were only half Jews, he must break off relations. She had replied, explaining that she and her brother Philip had attended the synagogue only rarely with their parents. Her father had always worked on Saturdays. Ham, bacon, and pork were eaten at home. There was an eclectic belief in the Almighty, but little more. This dispute rolled on for 17 years, at which point Robin revealed to the press that he had his grandparents' ketubah, or marriage certificate, which stated that the ceremony had taken place at the East London synagogue. Immediately, a raft of British papers pursued the story. The imputation was that Muriel had lied in her autobiography, concealing her Jewish origins. Finding herself accused of denial and a form of anti-Semitism, she eventually responded. Her undiplomatic reply: "My son has got in on the act because he wants publicity. He's never done anything for me except for being one big bore," merely fanned the flames. When she gave her interview, he replied indirectly with an article in the Edinburgh Star, the publication of the city's Jewish community, writing her out of his life. Muriel did not know that The Finishing School, her 22nd novel, would complete her oeuvre, but she wrote it as though it would, battling against acute pain. The final aria of the opera of her life, it orchestrates many tiny references to her earlier work around that perennial theme, the threat of the mundane to take over the original. In its way, it is a contemplation of her life as an artist, as though asking herself why and how she did what she did. A celebration of the imagination, of youth, the Holy Spirit, another satire on the inauthentic. The setting is an unconventional finishing school in Switzerland, which offers tuition in creative writing by Roland Mahler. One of his students, Chris Wiley, seems plainly more gifted than his tutor. Mahler comes to hate the boy, desire his death, and the destruction of his work. It is a study of the jealousy of talent. Throughout The Finishing School, Mahler suffers a choking sensation whenever he is gripped by envy of his pupil. 9 years earlier, Muriel had used this word to describe her lover Derek Stanford's enraged jealousy of her work. And this novel contains a message from the redeemed Mahler about vocation, for those who thought she had at times been harsh. "Art," he says, "is an act of daring. The true artist is almost unaware of other people's cares and distractions. Once you have written the end to a book, it is yours. Not only till death do you part, but for all eternity. Muriel had registered her last will and testament on the 1st of December 1998, after the racial origins dispute with her son. It left all her physical, literary and intellectual property in Italy to Penelope Jardine. She also deposited a letter with her solicitor, specifically excluding her son. He was another, she thought, who was jealous of her talent, and in the British press she was indeed presented as ruthless. At home, in San Giovanni, she could be her more authentic self. On the 29th of November, 2005, Muriel was admitted to Villa Donatello, a private hospital in Florence, where her right kidney was removed. Just before Christmas, she returned to convalesce. To friends and business associates, she wrote chirpily, hoping to be back to work within 3 months. But this time, it was cancer, and as soon as she knew that she was dying, she called for her priest, Don Gualtiero. She was, she told him, ready to die. She wished to leave this world simply, not dressed in her best clothes in the Italian funerary style, but wrapped in a shroud, not in an ostentatious coffin, but in one of legno fragile, thin wood, that decomposes easily, to be buried in the plain earth of the village cemetery. As Easter approached, she was taken by ambulance to another hospital in Florence, where she was attended by her private doctor. There, a priest heard her confession, and at 10:40, on the night of Maundy Thursday, the first day of the Passover, 13th of April, 2006, she died aged 88. Penelope Jardine was with her to the end. The formalities took place in Florence on Good Friday, and on Saturday she was taken to her local church for the funeral and burial. In the tiny walled cemetery, Muriel was buried beneath a simple grey stone slab inscribed Muriel Spark, Poeta, 1918-2006. Nessuna foglia si ripete, ripetiamo solo la parola. Not a leaf repeats itself, we only repeat the word. The quotation is from her poem, Canaan. The grave is surrounded by others with headstones bearing photographs of their incumbents. No headstone adorns Muriel's last resting place, no photograph. It is modest, almost anonymous in its plainness. But one person there, oddly the priest, had been troubled by her self-effacement and hoped that she would forgive him for his interference. Believing that Muriel's body should be preserved for future generations, he had recommended a solid, zinc-lined coffin to be buried not directly in the earth, but in a concrete niche. No matter how precisely she had tried to organise her death, others had intervened.
Muriel Spark, the biography by Martin Stannard, has been read this week by Hannah Gordon. The producer was Kirstine Cameron.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
So, on to drama at 3 o'clock. Hello, I'm Jim Lee, and we have the further adventures of Miss Lucilla Marshbanks as the Carlingford Chronicles continue for the next hour. There's a rather spooky disembodied train whistle echoing through the forests of Scotland. Find out why in today's 4 o'clock show, plus the physicists keeping Hollywood movies accurate. And later, how did Neolithic people experience the megalithic monuments we see today? Joanna Pinnock joins a team to find out at 8:30 this evening. Now, though, to Carlingford, where the machinations of Miss Lucilla Marshbanks, a large girl but not a tall one, lead to the solving of a mystery and wedding bells.
The Carlingford Chronicles by Margaret Oliphant. Miss Marshbanks, dramatised in four parts by Elizabeth Proud. With Elizabeth Spriggs as Mrs. Oliphant, Teresa Gallagher as Miss Lucilla Marshbanks, Paul Daneman as Archdeacon Beverley, and Keith Trinkle as Mr. Cavendish. Episode 3, Lucilla's Luck.
Archdeacon Beverley returned to Carlingford before Lucilla's evening on Thursday, by which time Mr. Cavendish had not recovered his courage so far as to propose to Miss Marshbanks. Everybody in Grange Lane remarked at the time how worried Mrs. Woodburn looked.
Yes. Her eyes have quite lost their brightness, poor thing.
Yes, and her eyes are the only beauty she has. Her nerves are in a dreadful state, and her temper...
I wonder why. She takes off the Archdeacon, you know, Mrs. Centum, quite savagely. Do you think she has some personal spite against him?
Ask her husband.
No, she don't know him. She's clever, and it carries her away, you know. But I can answer for it, she never saw the Archdeacon before. Now, her brother isn't here, of course. He has met everybody, I believe, one place or another.
Well, I understand Mr. Cavendish is with a friend who is sick on the continent.
Yes, poor old Harry.
Poor old Harry.
I heard that the friend was dying, and that Mr. Cavendish will inherit a large fortune.
This idea did credit to the imagination of Carlingford. But it was certain that Mr. Cavendish had once more disappeared into utter darkness.
Just as I had predicted.
So you did. Lucilla now made herself very agreeable to the Archdeacon, who unbended very much.
He is grown very nice, but I am uneasy about his opinions. He is ready to discuss anything. Still, he has good connections and a nice position, and the chance of being Bishop of Carlingford, of course, and one can never have everything one wants in marriage, you know, so on the whole, I don't see what difference his opinions make, so far as Lucilla is concerned.
Do you think he is paying attention to her?
Lucilla Marshbanks, a parson's wife? Never.
Yes, but, if he were to be made a bishop, you know...
Things were in this condition when it happened that the two subjects of this discussion met in a little lane running between Grove Street and Grange Lane.
Miss Marshbanks, you appear to be about to walk through the wall.
Good morning, Mr. Beverley. No, you see, there is a door.
Ah!
You may come in if you like. At least you may, if you will promise not to frighten the children.
Oh. Are there children?
Oh, there are a whole lot of children and a pretty governess. It is a school. I may call it my school, for that matter. I came to know her in the funniest way, and it was just my luck, as usual. If you will not say you are an archdeacon to frighten the children, I will let you come in.
When I am with the lady patroness, what does it matter what I call myself? Let me see how you manage your educational department.
Very well. You will be pleased with the governess. I'm sure she is a lady and has seen better days.
Ah, those dreadful women that have seen better days. It is hard to know how to get oneself into sympathy with those faded existences. They fill me with an infinite pity, but then what can one do? It is a great social difficulty.
There was something that morning in Mr. Beverley's tone and manner which struck Lucilla.
Yes, he is softened and mellowed, and his eyes have so much expression in them.
And he looked at Lucilla with such a marked regard.
It is impossible not to recognise that a crisis might be approaching.
Lucilla's protégé was Mrs. Mortimer, the same person whom the rector had recommended as her chaperone, but considerably changed since then.
She has grown younger by 10 years.
Quite. Lucilla had run about all over Carlingford for this feeble creature, searching for pupils, and at the same time had cut and...